Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Have a listen to this.
It is about 3:30 p.m. my time, so I'm definitely not doing this like Ander, because I'm awake. Sorry, Ander.
You zinged me. I'm kind of awake, although it is 2:37 a.m. for me, so I could be more awake. You know, I've done this podcast 600 days in a row now, or something like that, around 600, at least 600, which is crazy, right? And I've become very proficient. My skill set for podcasting and hosting a podcast has grown, you know, hugely since the start, to the point where I don't really edit the podcast anymore. I just hit record, talk, then hit stop, and that's what gets uploaded. Maybe like, I say like once a month, probably less than that. Once a month, I will do an edit if something happens, like if I've got to have a break in the middle of it to answer the phone, or not that anyone calls me at 2:30 in the morning. Yeah, I might chop a little bit out, but usually I just power through. The other day I hocked a loogie in the middle of the episode. I had hay fever. And thinking, okay, yep, I'll chop that out, obviously. I won't let that stay in. But forgot. Because I so seldom do chop something out that out of force of habit, I just forgot to do it. Which was silly. But yeah, so I've done this podcast so many days. I'm getting very good at podcasting. But rather than using that skill increase to give you guys a better podcast, all I did was use my increase in skill to put less effort into making the podcast. Less effort meaning, like, when I started this whole project a year and a half ago, well, nearly 2 years ago, every episode I had to chop bits out and edit them and redo bits, and I was like, there would be literally 30 to 50 edits per episode. It was crazy the amount of stuff I was chopping out. Now I just power through. And it's fine. There's no need to edit. Yeah. So that's what I mean by I'm not making a worse product. I'm just putting less effort in because I'm getting better at it. To the point where now I can basically podcast in my sleep. Like sometimes I'll be asleep, wake up in the wee hours in the morning realizing I haven't done the podcast, do it 99.9% asleep, and then go right back to bed. You guys aren't silly. You can probably tell how sleepy I am. Anyway, I should try to do it earlier, shouldn't I? So I've got my wits about me so I can actually be cohesive, coherent, whichever one of those two words means the thing I'm trying to say. Let's talk about Anna Karenina. Chapter 11 of Part 3. Thermos of Beer. Hey, haven't seen that name for a while. Thermos of Beer, how you doing? For a book called Anna Karenina, she's in it far less than I thought she'd be. Good point. And I never would have guessed there'd be so many chapters on mowing. I'm kind of hoping Anna never gets brought up again for the entire rest of the book, and the whole remainder is just lessons on agriculture by Tolstoy. Yeah, go Tolstoy. Give us some agriculture lessons. Mowing the book. You've done it in real life. Now experience it in book form, mowing the lawn. Simply Productive says, I would gladly learn how to do agriculture by Tolstoy instead of returning to those selfish pricks. even the beekeeping, which I know our host isn't too fond of. Yeah, that was me, the beekeeping chapter. That was my rant. Look, the guy knows his beekeeping, and I found it very interesting to learn about beekeeping via his broken metaphor. I just thought it was a dumb bit of writing. But hey, that's just me. Swims to the Mower Fishy said, in modern terms, I see 11 as management and the peasants as labor. Based on my own career, I do think 11 sees them as human beings who are equal to him, but because he is trying to maximize profits for his sister and the peasants and trying to maximize profits for their families, the business relationship is friendly but adversarial. Tolstoy told a naughty joke. Did he? Went over my head. Tolstoy told a naughty joke. When Levin asked the peasant if his son had any children, the peasant replied they had been chaffing him about that. The implication I took away was no, they didn't, because the son didn't know how to go about it. Okay, fair enough. Format Kakar said, in an overall sense, Levin seems like a good boss. He is genuine and professional. I can't judge much on the monetary basis, though. This chapter ought to soften Levin's feelings towards Kitty. This is probably what Levin will think now. Techrific says, maybe we're seeing the beginning of disillusionment about the peasants and the country life from Levin. Maybe he isn't so far removed from his brother in the sense of being a tourist to the countryside. The clash over the hay is indicative of a larger divide in thinking between the peasants and Levin. His reform ideas do not sit well with the folks that are used to doing it their way. His effort to find meaning in the countryside as opposed to the city life wasn't perhaps as easy as he first supposed. Both lives have their own specific set of challenges, but life is never easy. I think he's growing up in front of our eyes here. And lastly, Simply Productive said, Ander, that's me. No, I actually talk that fast. Lol. Yeah, that definitely goes to show why people say I steamroll them in conversation. I honestly thought I spoke at maybe, I don't know, maybe 75% of that speed. Wow. Gosh. Well, talk as fast as you want, I suppose. But the good thing about a podcast is no one can interrupt you, so you don't have to feel like you have to speed through it in order to get everything you want to say out. You can just kind of go at your own pace. But I suppose that is your own pace, if that's just what you're used to doing. So, Godspeed to you. It's not hard to listen to. It's not a complaint. I just thought maybe you were rushing it from, like, I don't know, from nerves or something like that, or adrenaline, you know. So I was just sort of saying, you know, take a breath, chill it out. But if that's your natural pace, then that's all good too. All right, that's the conversation had. Now let's return to the lovely Simply Productive, who will read us chapter, what are we up to? Chapter 12 of Anna Karenina. Thank you very much, Simply Productive, for these readings. It's been nice to be able to have a few days off from reading, and being read to for a change is really welcomed. Anyone wanting to give it a shot, like I said, just hit me up with a message via Reddit. You know, you can just send me a message or even a comment on the post. It's fine too. Let me know and we'll tee it up. You can do some chapter reading for us. I'm still trying to get Tech Griffig in. Tech, you know you want to do it, man. Come on. We all want to hear your voice. All right, cool. Thanks for listening. Enjoy this reading, and I'll see you tomorrow.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, today is the final reading I'm doing with you. This is Simply Productive. I did forget to tell you which translation I'm reading, and that's probably the most interesting part. I believe I'm reading the Garnet one. It just says translated from the Russian by Constance Garnet. But it's, I don't know, it's a little bit different in some ways from the other ones. It's got some really lovely illustrations. I picked this thing up in a used bookstore for maybe, I think, like $3 Canadian, which is, I don't know, like a buck American. Ooh. Our exchange rate is absolutely horrible. Yeah. So that's the translation I'm reading. It's been very nice to read with you guys. This is the last one I'm going to jump on board for. And I'm really, really nervous about hearing these podcasts back. I'm sure I'm just going to be sitting there going, oh God, do I really sound like that? Wow, what a horrible voice. Not the dulcet tones we've gotten used to. All right, but let's just jump straight into it. We're on to the part three, chapter, what are Roman numerals? This is an 11, isn't it? 12?
It's 12.
Oh, I'm so bad at this. And this is why I have a handy assistant helping me. Thanks, Tristan. All right. Here we go. So, part 3, chapter 12 of Anna Karenina. The load was tied on.
Yvonne jumped up, down and took the quiet, sleek horse by the bridle. The young wife flung the rake up on the load, and with a bold step, swinging her arms, she went to join the women, who were forming a ring for the haymakers' dance. Ooh, that sounds fun. Yvonne drove off to the road and fell in line with the other loaded carts. The peasant women, with their rakes on their shoulders, gay with bright flowers and chattering with ringing, merry voices, walked behind the hay cart. One wild, untrained female voice broke into a song and sang it alone through a verse, and then the same verse was taken up and repeated by 50 strong, healthy voices of all sorts, coarse and fine, singing in unison. The women, all singing, began to come close to Levin, and he felt as though a storm were swooping down upon him with a thunder of merriment. The storm swooped down, enveloped him in the haycock on which he was lying, and the other haycocks, and the wagon loads, and the whole meadow and distant fields all seemed to be shaking and singing to the measures of this wild, merry song with its shouts and whistles and clapping. Levin felt envious of this health and mirthiness. He longed to take part in the expression of this joy of life, but he could do nothing, and had to lie and look on and listen. When the peasants, with their singing, had vanished out of sight and hearing, a weary feeling of despondency at his own isolation, his physical inactivity, his alienation from this world, came over Levin. Some of the very peasants who had been the most active in wrangling with him over the hay, some whom he had treated with contumely, and who had tried to cheat him, those very peasants had greeted him good-humoredly, and evidently had not, were incapable of having any feeling of rancor against him, any regret. Rancor? Don't know. Rancor? This is when we Google how to pronounce this word. I didn't know the other one either, contumely. Yay for Shakespeare. Do we know how to say this? Rancor? No? Answer? Oh, that's so unhelpful. We're just coming up with Star Wars, folks. Not that that's unhelpful, but not quite what we're looking for. Different era. I'm going to go with Rancor. That's how I've chosen to pronounce it today. And if you guys say it's wrong, because I'm Canadian, I can say I'm using either the British or the American pronunciation. And I'm right either way, because Canada technically adopts British pronunciation and spelling, but in reality, we use American probably all the time. So, it's not my fault. I am Canadian. Where was I? I'll just start from the beginning again. Some of the very peasants who had been the most active in wrangling with him over the hay, some of whom he had treated with contumely, and who had cheated him, who had tried to cheat him, those very peasants had greeted him good-humoredly and evidently had not, were incapable of having any feeling of rancor against him, any regret, any recollection even of having tried to deceive him. All that was drowned in a sea of merry common labor. God gave the day, God gave the strength, and the day and the strength were consecrated to labor, and that labor was its own reward. For whom the labor? What would be its fruits? These were idle considerations, beside the point. Often Levin had admired this life, often he had a sense of envy of the men who led this life. But today, for the first time, especially under the influence of what he had seen in the attitude of Ivan Parmenov to his young wife, the idea presented itself definitely to his mind that it was in his power to exchange the dreary, artificial, and individualistic life he was leading for this laborious, pure, and socially delightful life. The old man who had been sitting beside him had long ago gone home. The people had all separated. Those who lived near had gone home, while those who came from far were gathered into a group for supper and to spend the night in the meadow. Levin, unobserved by the peasants, still lay on the haycock and still looked on and listened and mused. The peasants who remained for the night in the meadow scarcely slept all the short summer night. At first there was a sound of merry talk and laughing all together over the supper, then singing again and laughter. All the long day of toil had left no trace in them but lightness of heart. Before the early dawn, all was hushed. Nothing was to be heard but the night sounds of the frogs that had never ceased in the marsh, and the horses snorting in the mist that rose over the meadow before the morning. Rousing himself, Levin got up from the haycock, and looking at the stars, he saw that the night was over. "Well, what am I going to do? How am I to set about it?" he said to himself, trying to express to himself all the thoughts and feelings he had passed through in that brief night. All the thoughts and feelings he passed through fell into three separate trains of thoughts. One was the renunciation of his old life, of his utterly useless education. This renunciation gave him satisfaction, and was easy and simple. another series of thoughts and mental images related to the life he longed to live now. The simplicity, the purity, the sanity of this life he felt clearly, and he was convinced that he would find in it the content, the peace, and the dignity, of the lack of which he was so miserably conscious. But a third series of ideas turned upon the question how to effect this transition from the old life to the new. And there, nothing took a clear shape for him. Have a wife, have work and the necessity of work, leave Petrosko, buy land, become a member of the peasant community, marry a peasant girl. How am I to set about it? He asked himself again. I could not find an answer. I haven't slept all night. And I can't think it out clearly, he said to himself. I'll work it out later. One thing's certain, this night has decided my fate. All my old dreams of home life were absurd, not the real thing, he told himself. It's all ever so much simpler and better. How beautiful, he thought, looking at the strange, as it were, mother of pearl, shell of white, fleecy cloudlets, resting right over his head in the middle of the sky. How exquisite it all is in this exquisite night. And when was there time for that cloud shell to form? Just now I looked at the sky and there was nothing in it, only two white streaks. Yes, and how so imperceptibly, too, my views of life changed. He went out to the meadow and walked along the high road towards the village. A slight wind arose, and the sky looked gray and sullen. The gloomy moment had come that usually precedes the dawn, the full triumph of light over darkness. Shrinking from the cold, Levin walked rapidly, looking at the ground. What's that? Someone coming, he thought, catching the tinkle of the bells, and lifting his head. 40 paces from him, a carriage with four horses harnessed abreast was driving towards him along the grassy high road on which he was walking. The shaft horses were tilted against the shafts by the ruts, but the dexterous driver, sitting on the box, held the shaft over the ruts so that the wheels ran on the smooth part of the road. This was all Levin noticed, and without wondering who it could be, he gazed absently at the coach. In the coach was an old lady dozing in one corner, and at the window, evidently only just awake, sat a young girl holding in both hands the ribbons of a white cap. With a face full of light and thought, full of a subtle, complex inner life that was remote from Levin, she was gazing beyond him at the glow of the sunrise. At the very instant when this apparition was vanishing, the truthful eyes glanced at him. She recognized him, and her face lighted up with wondering delight. He could not be mistaken. There were no other eyes like those in the world. There was only one creature in the world that should concentrate for him all the brightness and meaning of life. It was she. It was Kitty. He understood that she was driving to Ergushovo from the railway station, and everything that had been stirring Levin since that sleepless night, all the resolutions he had made, all vanished at once. He recalled with horror his dreams of marrying a peasant girl. There only, in the carriage that had crossed over to the other side of the road and was rapidly disappearing, there only could he find the solution of the riddle of his life, which had weighed so agonizingly upon him of late. He did not look out again. The sound of the carriage springs was no longer audible. The bells could scarcely be heard. The barking of dogs showed the carriage had reached the village, and all that was left was the empty fields all around the village in front, and he himself isolated and apart from it all, wandering lonely along the deserted high road. He glanced at the sky, expecting to find there the cloud shell he had been admiring and taking as the symbol of his ideas and feelings of that night. There was nothing in the sky in the least like a shell. There, in the remote heights above, a mysterious change had been accomplished. There was no trace of shell, and there was stretched over fully half the sky an even cover of tiny and even tinier cloudlets. The sky had grown blue and bright, and with the same softness, but with the same remoteness, it met his questioning gaze. No, he said to himself. However good that life of simplicity and toil may be, I cannot go back to it. I love her. That is chapter 12. Thanks for listening. It's been very fun to join you guys. To never ever listen to my voice in these podcasts ever. But of course, I'll have to suffer through it for three whole podcasts. Thanks, Xander, for letting me join on. And Techrific, take back the reins, please. All right, you guys have a wonderful, I guess for me it's a day. I have no idea when you're listening to this. Have a wonderful existence.